if that's true, if you don't know who I am, then maybe your best course would be to tread lightly.
Welcome back to Cavaliers Break Bad, the sixth unofficial Breaking Bad podcast or something like that. I'm Saro.
I'm Crippy.
This show is stressful. It was a particularly dark episode this week, I thought.
Is that our thing now, that we just find the most tense, incredible moment and just play that?
Yeah, it was just kind of like, when we started the first episode of this season, it was kind of like, well, that was kind of broke open the doors and we had the big cataclysmic music. And then I'm like, well, we kind of got another one of those moments last episode, so I thought I'd just do it again. So yeah, I guess O Fortuna is our theme music. So no points for originality, but... That's something. Before I want to start, I just want to acknowledge this site, Tucker's Hole, which is a reference, an extremely geeky reference to, I think Cornered is the episode, a season 4 episode where Jesse and Mike are observing a junkie called Tucker.
Digging his hole. Played by Damon Harriman.
Yeah, actually. and that's the...
Who's an Australian.
On him.
Good on him.
On him.
On him.
He emailed me and asked for our details, and he's put together a Breaking Bad podcast guide. And yeah, he was very complimentary of us. And then I checked out the site. It's a good site, so I'm returning the favour.
It's real nice. Cheers, buddy.
Yeah, I think... Crap, I don't have the email in front of me, but his name was John, I think. Sorry, that's a bit poorly thought out. But yeah. Well. No, it's a good site, and we appreciate that. And he kind of... He didn't rank them or anything, but he listed them in order, and I think we were sixth or seventh or something. So yeah, maybe that will be our new kind of byline, the sixth best unofficial podcast.
Right on. So I'm pretty happy with
that. Let's dive in. I mean, overall, I just want to say that like when I put this up on the blog, I kind of don't have a pun to put up because it's just a generally stressful and upsetting episode of television.
Yeah.
Traumatic. Is the watchword here.
What? You're talking about Buried now.
What?
Buried.
Buried. Yeah, episode Buried. And actually, just, yeah, I want to talk about this title because it's like when I...
It is, yeah, it's so much fun. I mean, it's Breaking Bad. You can have so much fun
with the titles. But it's such a Breaking Bad title. Like,
yeah.
Grilled and cornered. And I kind of, when I saw it, I was like, shit, isn't there an episode already called Buried?
So what bearing do we have? I mean, obviously we've got Walt bearing the bat. Before we go into kind of like going through stuff chronologically, we've got Walt bearing the barrels.
Yeah, kind I mean, got... it's Walt bearing the barrels, and then there's just kind of this general sense of uncovering everything that they've buried over the years. One of those broad general titles that Breaking Bad loves, like cornered and grilled and any other verb titles.
Or stung by a dead bee.
Anyway,
maybe that'll assume a lot of importance maybe in the finale.
Bitten by a dead bee,
absolutely. I think really.
If we're working on... we're going on a weird tangent here, but if we're mentioning my theory that Walt got the ricin for himself, then, you know, it would be being bitten by a dead bee. Because if he's going out there with his machine gun and he's essentially a dead man because he's always already taken the ricin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's already... Why do we think this
episode from season 2 holds the keys to the finale?
Mate, it's just one of the random titles. We're just talking about random titles.
Yeah, anyway.
But the titles for this season are a lot of fun, and we get to have a lot of fun with them. Confessions next episode, particularly considering what
we've
kind of set up.
I'm looking forward to Ozymandias myself, because that's...
that's like... Oh, no, that's going to be incredible. But Confessions, like, starting, like, guessing we're going to start immediately with where we left off, as it has done for Blood Money and Buried. I mean, that's a good in, I suppose.
Well, let's talk about the cold open. And it was interesting, I was listening to the Insider podcast before you came, and they pointed out something which I picked up on, which was that it has this X-Filesy feel to it. It's kind of like, it's like finding the crashed flying saucer, particularly when he goes over that, I guess it's like a valley. He doesn't really see the car. He just sees this red light protruding from
that's
the darkness,
a good point, actually.
Which is so kind of, it's so got such cool. a sci-fi feel to it, particularly the sense that this is this rural guy. You know, he's the kind of person who would, you know, probably say, I found a money, and then they probed me, and then they...
this bloody young man, young people. But, yeah, no, that's really cool. Yeah, no, now you mention it, I can't see anything else. And, I mean, even the, And then you just end on Jesse, who's,
there's that happy
young chappy.
There's the great shot of, from above, Michelle McLaren directed this episode, my favourite Breaking Bad director.
Yes, and, we all know.
And this episode confirmed
Bring back Bernstein. Oh, that's all I have to say. Anyway.
You should get a t-shirt,
I should get
Bernstein,
a t-shirt saying
and it
bring
will
back
just,
Bernstein.
Like, that would just be nerdy t-shirt taken to the next
level.
Oh,
my God. Seriously. No, just while we're on it, just quickly, Box Cutter Mandala... ABQ, what's the Wendy episode? Half Measures. Like, you know, Bernstein, he's pretty much got my five favourite episodes, I reckon. So, up you go, Adam.
Anyway,
Michelle McLaren, Saro's favourite director.
Well, she did that great shot where she shot the, Jesse on the what are those called?
The merry-go-round?
No. Fuck. Roundabout.
Roundabout. Oh, yeah, roundabout. Yeah.
You know, the things that go round and about.
Oh,
those things. Yeah, that amazing shot where it's just him and then they bump in a bit. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great cold open. But the thing about this cold open is, it's Jesse is the subject of the cold open, and then we don't see him for the rest of the episode until the very end.
Which is a lovely bookend.
And it brings to mind, the cold open of Dead Freight with the little kid. And just having that thing as you kind of open with this really striking image that you just is pushed to the background. Until you get to the end. And I'm also think just structurally for this episode, it was really in their best interest to not really have Jesse in there. This was very much a family episode, and it really took me back to season two.
Yeah.
And kind of like in the first two seasons when the focus was more domestic, they kind of made this promise that, you know, one day we're going to see this family tear apart. And this episode was delivering on that promise.
Yeah.
And it was not nice. It was really unpleasant.
Yeah.
And the first scene after we have the credits, I love the garage door opening. And they step out, and they're kind of different men. And it's almost like it's an homage to Blood Money. It's an homage to the start of the first episode, because Hank walks out of that bathroom and he's someone different. And likewise, in this episode, they kind of step out of the garage and they're both different. And then immediately...
And it's a really nice... It's a really nice into that moment that puts you straight back there after the cold open is the yellow car that we notice. And it'd be one of those things that, like... It's a little tip of the hat to everyone who noticed it there. It's just like
everyone who has enough spare time to pick up on all these little,
or just even just get excited about it. It's like that. That's the show we're watching. Is that they are dipping the hat to us, and that's why we smile and laugh all day long.
Except I didn't laugh and smile at all during this episode. It was really fucking stressful.
I gotta do it, man.
We will get to that from ear to ear. So anyway, we then get to like a seven. You timed it 7 minutes. You actually timed
it.
Yeah, 7 minutes.
So
scene
it's
between
about
Hank and Skylar.
About 6:10 to about 13:30. So it's a good seven and a half minutes.
See, this is why we're the sixth best podcast, man.
Codes. All the details. Bro.
We give the time codes on the fucking episodes.
It's, you know, it's so yeah. It's a very substantial
scene. If you
want
to see some sad boob, turn to 22:38.
Why?
Get some...
Like, you're just discriminating against the South.
Yeah, I know. This is kind of
That's an Australian thing, I swear. If you're going to do an idiot, you're just going to do like, oh, mate, either one of these or South. Maybe that's an American thing, though, as well.
I think it's just a classist thing, really. I think it would be... I think it's less offensive because we're not, like, New York elites or anything. It's still somewhat offensive, but anyway.
I'm not from Texas, so I don't give a shit.
Anyway. There you go, in case you hadn't known, Crippy's not from Texas. Yeah, and this whole scene was really stressful to watch, because you really see how both of them are kind of fucked. I mean, Skylar can go both ways here. She can kind of get out in a really messy way, because she doesn't know how this can work out in her favour, in Walt's favour, and also her kids' favour. Mm. I mean, that's essentially the subtext of this whole episode is, how do we protect the children? Mm. And somebody, please think of the children.
It's one of those things, because you almost need the seven and a half minutes to kind of let it play out, because you just see the wheels turning in Skylar's head while you see Hank completely fixed. Like, he is not budging at all. He's got the same... It's one of the rare occasions in which bad acting teachers are in their zone, like, here's your objective and that's it.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
That's all there is to it. You know exactly what you want and you're going to get it. Like, it's one of the few scenes where it's played like that and it actually makes sense and you're not like, this is complete shit. But the thing is that you have... The only reason that it works is because you have Skylar on the other side of it, just in this quivering wreck.
Like, and kind of going, really, like, I could, you know, I... Once upon a time, I would have taken this option, but I'm too far in.
But the thing is, for me, it's almost a callback to that, when she's talking about to her lawyer saying, I feel like if I take a step in any direction, I'll make a wrong move. So yeah. She doesn't do anything. And we have the visual representation of that when she goes to the four corners and she keeps flicking the coin up and it keeps going, Colorado. It says, leave him. Like, about, she just doesn't. It's her inaction that
and she's
defines
got,
her.
She's got another out, but she's too... And I think at this point, she's just too far in. And actually, Skylar's massive downfall is that she constantly takes half measures. She is the most pragmatic cast member, but it kind of is... Sorry, character.
It's
but
very misplaced.
It's doing her in, because now she's kind of... She's not damned the same way Walt is, but she's enough caught up in his shit.
Mm.
And remember that the reason she became an accomplice was actually to help Hank. The whole reason... Yeah, this is something that I remembered from season 3. The reason she decided to go in with Walt, create that whole lie, start laundering the money, was so that they could pay for Hank's medical bills.
Oh, yeah.
Now, look, we can go... I mean, pinning down the accountability of Skylar is probably the hardest on the show, between her and Jesse. But she's fucked, essentially. So, yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things you almost need, like, a scale of the different kinds of evil. Like, there's just outright malice, then there's moral dislocation, and then, you know, there's just all this kind of complete... That's the whole... I suppose that's the whole point of that, is you've got this, like, scale which doesn't exactly have an X and a Y axis. It's kind of got all these different variables at play to, like, what really makes somebody evil. And that's the thing with Skylar, is that she's...
Oh, like, she's not evil.
No, but...
She's bad.
Good, bad, you know, like...
Well,
like,
yeah,
that's
she's
the thing, yeah.
But she's put herself in... It's, you know, it's the whole thing that actions have consequences, and she's kind of... She's past the point where she was sort of dragged into it by Walt. Mm. She's made a certain amount of choices, and now she really is in a position where she can't do anything other than stand by her man.
Yeah.
Which sounds really weird, but literally she kind of has to just be... on Walt's team, because that's the role that she's placed herself in and she doesn't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
I also just, in this scene, I love the way Hank is so convinced, and rightfully so, but it's really nice to just see him vocalize so clearly, even more than Mike was in last season, how awful Walt is when, you know, he says, oh, think of the things he's done, you know. I don't know if you know the extent of this, the amount of lives he's ruined.
Yeah.
And you know, he says, I'm going to put that animal away. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's the kind of language that I'd use to describe Walt. But for so long, you know, that kind of talk about Walt has really been something that's reserved for the viewers, because so few people for so long have had any knowledge of what he's done. Yeah. Nobody except for Saul knows that he poisoned Brock.
Mm.
And
even then, nobody knows about Jane.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, no, absolutely. But see, and that's the thing with, I think just that that's one thing for me in this scene is that Hank is so fixed and he's now so, he's got his objective.
Yeah,
he's found his objective, and it's so interesting to kind of see that play off Skylar in just kind of this like quivering, kind of terrified. Well, maybe not even that, just really weighing up the situation. And Hank pushes it way too much. And
yeah, for me, he does.
This is, I mean, we've kind of see it kind of come in different places, but this for me is almost like Hank's hubris kind of coming through.
Yeah,
Hank's
definitely.
Pride. Like he even says, like, I don't want this bastard running out the clock. Like he like Walt's going to die, whether he's like, surely, you know, to somebody maybe, whether he sizzles in an electric chair or whether he passes away from cancer, that, you know, that's kind of immaterial. But to Hank, it's like, fuck that, he's sizzling.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of reflecting what the audience wants. Yeah. Like, I don't want this guy to go gently into that.
Yeah, but that's the thing. And he also says, if what I know is true, how dare he question me? And that's the thing. And it's like, for me, knowing all that in comparison to Hank, when he first starts talking to Skyler at the beginning of the scene, he says, when did you know? And he stops at Skyler going into the pool in 51. And you're just like, that's why you're struggling with, because he can't, he can't see the woods for the trees.
No, and this is why Walt got away with it for so long.
Exactly.
Once Hank has a lead, he's unstoppable, but he really has a hard time kind of changing his mind.
Mm. Actually, rather, he can't see the trees for the woods. He's focusing too much on the big picture, not enough on the actual detail within it to kind of find what he needs to see.
Well, maybe. I generally think that he's making the same mistake with Skyler that he made with Walt. He just assumes that those close to him can't have done bad things. Or he can't look outside his kind of concept. Like, once he was tipped off about Gus Fring, he was completely really looking into it. You know, same with Walt, but, you know, it would take a lot for him to believe that Skyler is complicit with all his actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something I will kind of come back to, and this is a more broad point rather than anything specific to this episode, but it's kind of about just more and more having just finished season 4 and also kind of watching this and kind of thinking almost in the same light about Gus, Walt, Lydia and Hank. For me, this show is becoming, you know, I've kind of just seen it described like in various places by people not really in the know as like a crime show. And it's really not a show about crime. It's about power and it's about emperors. Mm. And it really is like Hank now, he's ASAC, you know, he's kind of got his own power structure, which props him up as Gus did, which Walt destroyed, developed his own in accordance with Lydia, who has an immense power structure.
Yeah.
And the thing is, each of them has their own kind of, has their own hubris, which ultimately turns their story into a tragedy.
Yeah, that's a different kind of hubris.
And that's the thing is that almost, and I mean, we see it with Lydia, and I wanted to speak more to it when we get to Lydia with her thing, but it just to establish it now, just a really, really strong theme you're really starting to come through, and particularly prescient considering what we've got coming with Ozymandias
as
a theme in a whole.
Yeah, it's with the whole trailer for Ozymandias and the fact there's an episode of that. I mean, just the kind of nature of power.
And the disintegration of a power structure.
But I mean, that's something you always kind of saw with Breaking Bad from the get-go.
Yeah.
It's also interesting, you know,
yeah, but
sort
it's
of just random, you know, jumping in. I mean, you watch Game of Thrones, which is another show that's essentially just about power and the
various
structural power.
But that's a different one because there are actual, like, kings and stuff. Like, there are just kind of different power structures. Like, to the point where I don't think Hank, at least in the way I'm kind of looking at it, added himself as an emperor as such.
Mm.
And particularly in the way that Breaking Bad looks at emperor and empire as really kind of an interesting, dramatic focus until you see a fatal flaw come out, which you know is going to be a spanner in the works for their...
Yeah, and you kind of see that. Actually, you know, thinking about this, I was just... Yeah, so, like, going on to other television again, you've just kind of got the wheels turning.
Yeah.
Gus Fring has this side to him that really reminds me of Stringer Bell.
Yep.
And then he's someone who's sort of loves taking an illegitimate industry and giving it this sense of legitimacy and bringing his own
as well.
Yeah.
That Walt's
and kind of that he's the villain that you want.
And that's
and that
so
when
much
he,
yeah,
and
yeah,
that
yeah.
when he goes, it just takes on this new level of ruthlessness and depravity when Walt and Lydia
and that's something that the Wire hit on so much as well, like the illegitimate practices being totally fair game for a good businessman. And that,
it's just a mirror
but
of that, capitalism.
But yeah,
it's just like
of course, exactly. And that, and you've even got it in just in the "I am the one who knocks" speech. He like what he says is like a business big enough to be listed on the NASDAQ. Yeah. I don't turn up for work; it goes belly up. You know, like it's a very clear cut kind of, you know, just reference to that. And and particularly the continuation of that with Lydia, who's within a bigger corporate structure.
Yeah, well, let's get to Lydia later. Yeah. Anyway, then we get my favorite scene in this episode. Well, but just the most
fun. The funniest, like unquestionably.
Huel and Kubi, so Bill Burr and, what was the name? Laverne...
Crawford, I think, yeah.
And he...
Lavelle Crawford.
Yeah. And he just looks at the money and says... And you actually see his face, like he really is fighting temptation. Like he has this pained expression of,
I gotta do it, man.
And then
as if like there's only one thing in his head. The only thing in your head is gotta do it, man.
Gotta do it. Gotta pull the Scrooge McDuck. It's just the fact that you have the fattest character currently on television jump onto a pile of money. Oh, I don't know. There's just something so brilliant about that image.
Yep.
And then the line. The other thing about this scene is, apart from the fact that it's just fucking great, is it gives us an opportunity, which I think I always appreciate on this show, to kind of pull out and give us some perspective on Walt and his operation from characters who don't really know him and know his weaknesses. Because we kind of go, oh, yeah, Heisenberg, but we still see the quite feeble, stressed out, often erratic middle-aged man that is Walter White. Mm. So, but from their perspective, you know, guy killed, you know, 13 or 10 prisoners in a 2-minute window, all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And we've kind of said, and they just don't have time to do it now that they've only got a few episodes left, but it was a real shame that Breaking Bad never got to do a, like, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, a dead style take with either Badger and Skinny Pete or Kubi and Huel.
And that's the thing. Like, I was going to say, like, people have kind of been, well, people, us, I mean, probably everybody, Skinny Pete as, like, they've outed themselves as the true Rosengill of this show. No.
Yeah,
like,
Kubi and Huel.
Challenges for the crown.
Yeah, and see, I always was either Skinny Pete and Badger, you know, they're always there, but now I'm thinking, Kubi and Huel.
They're
pretty fucking hilarious.
And again, Better Call Saul, like...
Yeah, actually, yeah. Well, that's true. And in fact, if you wanted to get cynical about it, you could argue that the screen time of them and Saul is a way to set up that show.
No, I don't think either way it is.
Yeah.
And it would be awesome. So, you know, like that's pretty beautiful. But it's also just showing, like, they're just showing off now how many strings they have to their bow. Just like,
Kubi and Huel, we haven't seen enough of them. And I guess if there are characters that'll carry over, it'll be them.
Yeah.
And hopefully Badger and Skinny Pete.
Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
Anyway, we get the scene in Saul's
funniest
office.
Show.
Yeah, where he's talking about the trip to Belize.
And this is fun. I've kind of picked up on something, potential foreshadowing. When Saul suggests that maybe we send him to Belize, where we sent Mike, talking about
and
Hank.
And Walt's indignation.
Is insane.
Oh my God, he's so pathetic.
And you're just like...
Hank's family, I would never hurt family, I'm a good boy.
Yeah, it's so funny still seeing that come out of his mouth.
Oh, I know.
And you know, but you're just like, bloody hell.
But
potential foreshadowing, and he's like, send Hank to Belize, I'll send you to Belize.
Yeah, so...
Walt will kill Saul?
I just think though that when shit gets really real, Saul will run.
Yeah.
And that gives
or, and, give us... and maybe literally go to like just literally go
yeah,
to Belize.
Yeah, that would be quite yeah, that's what I was thinking. What if he actually went to Belize? And then we get the other scene, which is another
great...
Get
like Shakespearean miscommunication, like he's gone to Belize. Oh.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, he's like an episode later after shit's hit the fan. No, he's literally gone to Belize.
And then we get another scene that kind of adds to that whole thing of like the Rosengill element where like, Walt is given... The money is driven to Walt by Kubi and Huel. And he just kind of really just looks at it. You know, I thought you'd want to count it. You figured right. Then he gets it close enough. Like, he's really just plays that bad, ruthless boss role
ruthless, but like I'm so great, I don't even give a shit about you bastards. Because I mean, like,
yeah, but like he knows or he assumes. It's just it kind of confirms he's aware of what his standing is in their eyes, and he wants to confirm it. He needs to confirm it. So I thought that was nice. And then he goes to the desert, and in case you were wondering, yes, it's the same place that they shot the pilot.
Cool.
Yeah, I know. Cool. That's there ain't no two ways about it, guys. Yeah. That's just downright cool.
So what, like even near the gas mask? Like
Yeah, where they cooked up for the first time. It's the same general area that they shot the pilot. Because, I mean, there's plenty of desert. Oh, look, I don't know exactly, but I do know that it's the same land that they shot the pilot. And that would make sense in-universe as well. I mean, he's going to the desert. It's part of the desert. Sure. He's been there before. Yeah. And, I mean, Michelle McLaren, as she proved in 4 days out, she knows how to shoot some desert.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to, I think, the scene that's, like, my favourite in the sense that it's the most dramatically strong, but not necessarily pleasant to watch, which is the confrontation between Skylar and Marie.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, Skylar and Marie, I guess Skylar, Marie and Hank, but Skylar and Marie are essentially the focal point of this episode, which is something that many fans would not really be open to. It's they get rid of Jesse and hone in on the family, which I think was really smart and was something I'm really interested in seeing. But I can imagine a lot of people going, "Come on, blow off some faces again." Mm. But yeah, I think this really works. And then we get this scene between where, well, first of all, I just want to mention, and this is where the film nerd geekiness comes in, is that the way they shoot the house, they give this sense, they zoom out. So Skylar feels kind of really small in the space of the house, but also at the same time, she's very much trapped. Mm. And this kind of, the way you frame someone in a domestic space that way, really reminds me of the melodrama kind of tradition of Douglas Sirk and Ren Werner Fassbinder.
Mm-hmm. Particularly Fassy, I reckon.
Well, yeah, but...
But, yeah, no, which, of course, Sirk. You know, yeah, it's all...
Yeah, sure, whatever. Lineage, yeah. But, so, and it works. And, yeah, and this whole absolutely. Scene works from that not melodramatic as in bad drama, but specifically the genre within cinema.
Again, the time code on this one, 2030 roughly to about 26. So, like,
another 6-minute scene.
So it's 5.5 minutes from about Skylar opening the door to Marie saying, "You've got to get him," which the scene doesn't end up until that point. Like, it's not enough for them to leave the house because this scene so much is about the line in the sand, and we've already had it drawn with Walt and Hank, and now we really see it with Skylar and Marie.
And she has to pick a side, and she chooses Walt.
Exactly. Well, see, this is the thing. It's a massive moment. And, I mean, even just for Marie as well. Just, like, no...
Yeah, definitely.
For, like, for me, it's a bigger moment for Marie. Like, to go against her sister. Like, that's, you know, that's however many decades of you know...
Also, I mean, like, if Hank and Walt fall out, that's one thing. But, I mean, if Skylar and Marie fall out... But also, Brandt has been saving this performance for 5 years now, because it's...
And it's really good.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Really, but she, you know, she often doesn't get much to do. She's the comic relief / annoying relief.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. Marie really comes into her own. Not even in... It's kind of difficult to say this episode because this is the only scene she's in. Is it, are you pretty sure?
Wait. Yeah. She's in it at the end. It just feels like her presence is central for this episode.
It really is. Which you would
never say about Marie.
This is where she really asserts herself. Like, as I was saying just a bit early with Hank kind of going all the way back to 51, which was all of 4 episodes ago, Marie doesn't stop. Marie keeps going.
Yeah.
Marie doesn't have any vested interest in bringing down her personal white whale, Heisenberg.
Yeah.
She just wants to, find out what's going on with her family.
And that also feeds into, the reaction that Marie would naturally take, which is to basically try and steal the baby. And the thing is, like...
I think steal is the wrong word. Save. You know, it depends. Well, I suppose it depends on who now you're experiencing.
Well, I'm not
the show with.
It's, oh yeah, sure. Like, I'm not. I don't judge Marie for that, but it's still.
Oh, what the kleptomania? Like,
yeah. Well, that's that was the other thing. But like, it's still like rationally, Skylar's not gonna go, you know, sell the baby for some meth. It's not. I just think that was a completely raw emotional reaction by Marie. From a very raw emotional character. Yep. And that's the thing. That's the kind of the danger when this thing that's been buried for so long comes out. People like Marie, you just don't know how they're going to react, or you do know, and it's going to be cataclysmic.
Now, okay, yeah, but just I'm just going to I think this is a potential foreshadowing or plot point. I think that here we kind of see, obviously, Skylar committing herself to almost even just the family home, just as broadly signifying her commitment to Walt and her family. And you've got Marie trying to take Holly out of that environment, and like for the sake of Holly. Mm. And then you've got Hank saying no for the sake of his investigation, ultimately, just to kind of just get some kind of normalcy in there and just get on with it, get back, get into safer territory than this, and then kind of get ready for, you know, the final showdown or whatever. For me, those two points that Hank is thinking in that moment about something other than family and something other, and Marie is thinking about Holly, I think, and we've seen the foreshadowing of Holly's death coming in different aspects, I think if Holly now dies, that drives a massive wedge between Hank and Marie. Because Marie wanted to take Holly out of the house, and Hank wants to commit to his investigation.
Yeah.
If Holly then dies, then it's because of the investigation, and then it makes it a face-off in a way. Like, it's like, fuck your investigation. If it wasn't for your investigation, Holly would be with us and alive. I think that's a potential
plot thread between
the two of them.
Yeah, I think you got a point there. Another thing about this episode is the way that Marie slaps Skylar. Yeah. It sort of has that same... It mirrors the way Hank punches Walt in the previous episode. Yeah, and it's just... There's just a lot of Schrader-on-white violence going on all over the place. But then we go to this... also, one thing is when Hank and Marie are in the car and they're both utterly distraught, and Marie says, "You've got to get him." I just kind of thought, like, it's kind of sweet in a really fucked up way. Yeah. I mean, like, the thing is, like, this level of honesty and sort of, like, and synchronicity, that wouldn't happen with Walt and Skylar. Yeah, they clearly are, actually, even though Marie is fucking a lunatic and Hank is kind of pretty fucked up in his own right, they're actually a really good couple in their own strange way.
They made me think of the purple dress and the white Stetson hat photo. It's just,
They've kind of demonstrated this before. Yeah. This was like, you know, a way to keep demonstrating that in a good
way. Absolutely, yeah.
So then we see Walt bury the barrels, and this was just kind of like Michelle McLaren having a Michelle McLaren. Festival. So we get three point of view shots from inanimate objects. We get the one where he's digging, where he's breaking the earth, and then you get where the dirt's kind of wiped off the camera, which is classic Breaking Bad. We then get the slightly more innovative and quite sexy... Well, my computer ran out of battery, so I'm going to have to do this all from memory. Quite sexy shot of the camera being attached to the barrel, and then we see it roll down. We all feel sick. And then, of course, we get the, just kind of for the heck of it, we get the coordinate locate.
And then, and a rack of focus, which doesn't happen as often with these ones. So it goes from the numbers to Walt's face. That's
interesting.
There you go.
Yeah. But he smashes that.
Yeah. So the coordinates also, are those of the ABQ studio in which they shot, which is a fun one.
Yeah. But, and I hear that if you go and dig underneath there, you will find some money, some buried treasure.
Anyway, just another one also that Sarah noticed.
I noticed this and you didn't, which I'm kind of quite disappointed in you. There's a shot basically when Walt is laying down in the hole he's dug for himself. Wow, that sentence just has so much symbolism in it. Anyway, he's laying down in the hole that he's dug for himself. And you see, and the camera is shooting directly above through the back of the truck, so he, like a small space.
Through two cartons, or barrels full of money.
Through two barrels of money. And
creates a rectangle.
Creates a rectangle, and Walt's dusty and dirty and exhausted. And it's, seriously, go back and watch it. It is such a direct homage to the infamous end of Crawl Space. Like, that shot, it's so similar.
Yeah.
The framing of it, and also just what Walt looks like. Mm. He's kind of sprawled, he's dirty, he's exhausted, he's
not,
stressed.
He's not laughing maniacally.
No. yeah, it's kind of also like he's past that point. He's so fucking...
Well, he's got the cans back. He's got the cans back.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so, I mean, there's that great shot.
Yeah, which is a fun one. So, yeah, it's Michelle McLaren actually having a bit of a Scott Winant moment, actually.
Yeah,
so
Scott Winant, director. Yeah, well, we'll talk about him when we do our season 4 podcast.
Yeah, no. Fine.
So, yeah, that's a great directed sequence. And then it cuts into a really nice little clever touch by the writers, which is the way he memorizes it is through the lottery ticket.
Which would be fun if it came back, like if he won.
Oh, it'll so come back. Oh, well, I don't think he'll win. Oh, my God, if he won. Oh, that would be brilliant.
How would you... I can't really... Oh, no. Nah. I don't know. What does
Or not if he wins, but like if we just hear a television in the background read it out and they never claim it they're all dead.
No, oh, my God. Or no, if there's like one remaining person and it's Walt Jr. or something, and he's like, I've got no money, and the one thing that like gives, like even just everyone, like even Hank and Marie, just everyone's dead except Walt Jr. and he's just got the only thing. Oh wait, no, I'm not gonna do that voice. That's just mean. The only thing I've got left is this lottery ticket, and he wins, and you're just like, well, it was all worth it.
And you win a lifetime supply
of crystal meth
of breakfast. yeah, anyway, so we then get this really quite harrowing sequence with Lydia and Todd and our favourite gang of Nazis.
No, that's not, no. Before that, we've got, the scene.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Back
sorry.
In the house where Walter,
see, my
where,
computer
Walt's,
ran out of
yeah,
this is what
where
happens.
Walt, where Walt's come back to the house and Skylar's like, what the hell, man?
Yeah, and also just the way they frame that, the way they shoot the house when Walt comes in, it's kind of dimly lit. It's really, he's isolated and trapped, and they really know how to make that house be unpleasant.
Yeah,
even before
and
they tear it apart, yeah, like they did at the start of the season.
They've been shooting in it for a while. They really have found their way around the space.
To
they
make
know
it
how
a
to
really
just,
uninviting, horrific space.
Kind of... Yeah, just gothic with just
walls
and just, you know,
with walls. I know the
without,
walls, right?
Yeah,
what,
but there
what's
are
with
no,
that?
There are hardly gargoyles inside the
no,
White House.
No, I know
so
what you mean. Turn this kind
just
of
like,
which is
very
the dark underbelly of suburbia, which is the show essentially. Well, I mean, actually, it's Lynchian essentially.
Yeah, I was just thought you were about to say that, but I was just like, oh, that's an interesting comparison. But
yeah,
I'd never
compare something to David Lynch.
No.
That's a reference to our other podcast.
Yeah. Anyway, so with this, I just think in this scene, you've got a really, it if not for how brilliantly it's shot, it could almost be a season 1 scene, a floating season 1 scene. Just
yeah, no. Well,
that,
it's,
that's
no,
the thing.
But
it's such
an
a clear. Homage
but
or reversion back.
This whole episode is like an homage to.
Well,
a
see, that's
one
the thing. Stylistically, you've kind of got like an homage to what they've kind of been doing for so long, particularly the Michelle McLaren sequences.
Yeah.
But just with the action of it, Walt collapsing, showing this extreme vulnerability which he has not shown or allowed himself to show, which he hasn't even had to show for a really long time. It's pretty much since he's been in remission. So. And that's like way back in season 2, season 1 kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so
but the thing is also that's really important about this is
it's
he
like
collapses
limp caterpillar
on the
period.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Yeah,
except we know he goes even more beardy.
Yeah, no.
But the thing is that he collapses on the bathroom floor, and that is the scene that is where Skylar consoles him. And this is now look, I think when we went back and did it, there is a scene where she comforts him on the bathroom floor. Similar to this. And look, if it's not an homage to that, I don't know, maybe my memory is kind of...
I'm pretty sure he just passed out in the bathroom.
Yeah, he passed out in the bathroom.
And then
he gets
his shit together.
But then there's another scene, of course, during season 5, during 51, where Walt is reminding Skylar, at the worst possible fucking time, how she comforted him on the bathroom floor when the cancer was back and he was dying.
That's right.
So that is... a clear nod of the hat to kind of Skylar having to be the rock of the family.
And almost just in this scene, from where we've kind of come, particularly with season 5, just with the way Skylar has regarded Walt, even in Blood Money, she was, when Walt's talking about getting 2 car washes, she's just like, yep, I wish I was dead. Yep, cool, yep. And then just from that, it's so after this altercation with Hank and then Marie just rattled by it, Walt's now her rock in a way. After having been completely cut off from that other aspect of the family.
Yeah, exactly. All she's got is Walt. All she's got. She hasn't got Marie. She hasn't got Skylar. She hasn't got Marie. She hasn't got Hank. Although she kind of does. That's in a later scene. Hank actually says, you know, we can get Skylar out of this when she comes to her senses. Because obviously he doesn't feel kind of betrayed by Skylar the way Marie does.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, and that whole scene, there's also, actually speaking of 51, in fact, this whole episode kind of had a 51 quality to it because, I mean, it really was sort of, it was looking at the domestic situation in light of the recent events. She says, is it true your cancer's back? And he says, you know, does that make you happy? Mm. She says, I can't remember when I was happy.
Yeah, fun.
Mm. What a nice show.
But see, the thing is, the thing that's so interesting about this scene is, particularly in comparing it to something from season one, is that in that situation you've got this cancer-ridden, just basically fucked pauper. Now you've got a cancer-ridden, basically fucked emperor. The thing is, it's a really just a nice kind of parallel to say, this is still the same frail human, but now what he decides will affect people, rather than just being just some little dickhead kind of doing... Rather than being Hal
from Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah, well, yeah. See, and it's kind of, like, touching, but also fucking terrifying as well, because, like, when you've kind of seen it, and it kind of almost re-acclimatizes you to that, like, science teacher's bathroom floor.
Yeah.
When you kind of think about it in the context of the Emperor, like the elevated, like broad-reaching consequences that can come from any of his actions, then it makes it a palatial environment. And you're just
speaking of the broad-reaching consequences of his actions.
Are you trying to move us along to something in particular?
Yeah, well, actually, I know. I just thought that was a genuinely nice segue because, we see the consequences of his actions in that he has left this massive hole in the Albuquerque meth market, which sounds kind of like a local emporium, the Albuquerque meth
market. I don't really think, like, if we're going to talk about the consequences of Walter White / Heisenberg's actions, decreased quality of meth. Like,
no, but it is. It's because he left this hole, people are dying, and then Lydia and... Oh, this seems great. Because, of course, she's let in blindfolded, and then she sees the meth lab. And then when...
With the mini Heisenberg club, just all of Declan's guys. Like, we just look out for them. Yeah. There's these bald guys with Heisenberg little goatees. The amount of people
who essentially look like they've dressed up as Walter White for Halloween is absurd.
Obviously, the Say My Name sequence kind of had just as big an effect in that world as it did in ours.
Well, what's so fascinating about this scene is they all refer to Heisenberg. Whereas, like, that's kind of quite a new phenomenon. I mean, obviously people like Badger and Skinny Pete and kind of... But, you know, Gus or Tuco once he found out, and all those, you know, the big players, they don't say Heisenberg. They know that he is, you know, a fish out of water. But Declan... Mm. And even Lydia, who knows who he is, think of him as this big, scary guy, this kingpin called Heisenberg, this urban legend.
By that point, you know, he'd killed Gus and...
And all those guys in prison. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that would have done wonders for his reputation.
Exactly. See, that's the thing.
The Heisenberg PR team were working overtime there. Mm. But, yeah, and then... So it's interesting, once again, it's interesting to see the kind of outsider perspective on what's happened, but then Nazis show up and kill everyone, which is always a sentence that signifies good things.
Yeah, and young Meth Damon.
Meth Damon.
Yeah.
Jesse Plemons playing Jesse Plemons.
Todd.
Todd. Okay. If you forgot that character's name, comes and plays this young southern gentleman to Lydia. And like, as we I think we said, this is one thing we kind of said to each other before we actually sat down to do this, was that this is just such a fucking extreme visual metaphor for like corporate America. Mm. You know, the idea of I want to do horrible things, I don't want to see it. So literally being led through this maze of dead bodies of her collateral damage, but I don't want to see anything, like this shielded figure of power.
Mm. And see that, and again, this is where you make a real distinction between crime and power. Mm. Is that with Declan, kind of Declan's the only one who isn't dead. I swear to God, anything other than this...
Well, he's dead now.
Shut up. Anything other than this, when he's crawling along on the way out, yeah, sure, but, like, crawling, anything other than this, the Lydia in that situation, or at least the figurehead of whatever organization is carrying out this massacre, would take a gun,
yeah,
say three badass sentences while Declan pleads for his life, and then say something like, "It's already done," and then shoot him in the face.
But
this is not about crime. It's about power and the way that power structure allows crime to happen by not implicating or making people responsible for their actions.
Yeah, exactly, which is what the whole of the show is about. It's like, you know, Walt coming... Well, if he doesn't, the viewer coming to terms with his actions having consequences. And that's why Lydia, effectively, is a really perfect final villain for the show. Someone who is so removed from their consequences, so removed from what their actions can do, just has this complete lack of morality, but complete lack of sort of accountability and recklessness. I mean, she's dangerous. She really is.
Yeah, she really, really is.
Really is dangerous, and she's both extremely cold and calculating and erratic. I mean, she's
a nervous wreck.
But it's like if you put Tuco in charge of the Fring Empire, you know what I mean? And then, but without any sense of but completely insulated. Because, you know, we knew Gus would get his hands dirty, but he was
also... In terms of being insane, like just...
Yeah, in terms of being erratic. You never knew what Tuco was going to do.
Yeah,
never
right,
know what Lydia's
sure,
going to do.
Sure.
But
and she's kind of the inverse of Tuco, but remaining that one core principle.
Yeah, and Gus, of course, was all about this sense of
reliability,
hiding in plain sight
yeah.
and, you know, and
yeah,
order.
Absolutely.
And she's kind of got that element as well. And she's got Walt's element of sort of, you know, never being accountable. But even Walt was willing to get his hands dirty. So pissing off Lydia was a bad decision, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And but
in Blood Money, you mean when Skylar tells her to get out, and not come back.
Yeah, that was
absolutely
dumb.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that Lydia is a really good villain to end the show on, in that she kind
absolutely
of represents what the show's getting at. Is
yeah,
the way
absolutely
that we kind of justify and remove ourselves from the consequences of our actions.
And also, see, for me, another really important aspect of this, though, is that by... And again, this show is so much about how incrementally kind of allowing yourself to kind of get... allowing yourself and allowing your conscience to get away with stuff that gets incrementally worse. Gradually, you get to a point where you don't recognize yourself, which is so much of what Walt is about. And I find that visual metaphor really strong in the Whirligig, whatever it is, the fan that lets through one bullet shell into the underground bus meth lab, which isn't filthy, which is dimly lit, as Declan says.
Yes,
lovely.
Not filthy. You can imagine if Walt saw that.
There's one shot seeing Lydia through the fan, and I find it to just almost be a really nice visual metaphor for the state of allowing yourself to get away with things. Just seeing that, just seeing the, you know, there is that, like, sure, there's a lot of stuff blocking shit out, but there's a lot of air in there. There's a lot of light coming through, and there's a lot of stuff that's going to get through there.
Yeah.
It's going to putrefy your fucking soul.
Mm.
So, you know, good on you, Lydia. You just, I'm scared of Lydia.
I know. I think, as I said, we fucking underestimate Lydia. But yeah, and this, Mike said this back in season 5, you know, I should have killed her and I wasn't. It was because I was sexist, because I thought that this small, frail little woman in her suits and her rental cars could not possibly wreak havoc on these big, tough,
with
burly men. And particularly because Breaking Bad is such a masculine show in many ways. It's all about men being, you know, I mean, Walt's journey is so much going away from emasculation. It's so perfect that our final villain is this really, not just feminine, but, you know, someone who goes against every kind of cliche of sort of the masculine criminal.
And
everyone's going to underestimate her.
Yeah.
Declan did. Walt has. Skylar has. Mike did. Jesse did. Everyone has underestimated her, and it's going to be their undoing.
And it's so interesting to kind of see that she really isn't... It's kind of... You're not scared of Lydia. You're scared of the power she has and the fact that somebody like her has that power. Like, Lydia without power is... But you can be scared of Tuco without power.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it. And that's the massive difference between the two.
But at the end of the day, like, that's all that really matters. Yeah, at the end, because like at the once Tuco lost his gun, you know, it was just kind of like
you're just a crazy guy.
I mean, Tuco didn't last long for a reason.
Partly he is a Salamanca. They have been known to like continue charging towards you while like having their limbs shot off. Like they won't quit.
Yeah. But the thing, Lydia's playing a long game.
The thing with Lydia that interests me so much is that what, you know, and it's so, such good character development is that they all have this really kind of intense hubris, but they're so different. All the Emperors, the Gus, the Walt, the Lydia, and now the Hank, they're so different in their own ways. And for me, the I don't want to see line is such a massive parallel with Walt.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But the thing that makes Lydia worse for me is that I don't think necessarily that her kind of incremental development into will be like, I don't think we've got another Heisenberg.
Oh, no.
But that's what makes her so scary is that the more power she develops for herself and like making a decision like this, getting Todd on board, whatever, a $50 million shortfall she's talking about will now be saved. So she'll be that much, much more wealthy. More power, just like developing her network and just becoming absolutely further and further away from her actions that she carries out, which makes it much more scary.
Yeah. Because
broader network, more people killed with no blood on her, well, no lit, like blood on her hands. It's brilliant.
And if you wanted to really go into your kind of political economic theory, you could talk about how the general capitalist structure makes people more sociopathic and less. But anyway, we won't do that. That's we can save that for our Why a podcast. But yeah. Anyway, we really should wrap this up soon. Just want to talk about the scene with Jesse at the very end. Once again, I like the fact that they keep Jesse out of it until the very end because you get that sense of bookends. And also the fact that I think if we cut to Jesse during this episode, it just wouldn't have worked. It would have seemed functional. And I think it was good that they had the balls to keep him out.
I don't know why, but it reminds me of, I think it's episode 5, season 3, Mass, which is the one that starts with...
I think Mart.
Mars, whatever. The one that calls back to I Am Awake and then ends up with Jesse and Combo in the titty bar.
Yeah.
And then ends with that photo coming into Hank's hands. Like, I just,
oh, yeah.
That one is the best bookend, I think, because it really, like, it's a plot thread, like, and it's also just brilliant, and it's a callback. So, you know, you've just got all these, like, some of the best aspects of Breaking Bad just all there.
And one of the things I also love about this scene is they get back the two detectives from
Face-Off, yeah.
Who interviewed Jesse when he said about the rice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just got the writing in that. It's so funny. I got a bladder as big as a hot water bottle.
Oh, they're such dickheads. They're so good. Such dickheads.
Episode from their perspective, I'd like to see as well. And then, of course, Hank gets his way in. And I mean, look, I don't have much to talk about, really, this one. I'm sure the scene that it is inevitably setting up for next episode is really where the meat lies.
It'll be interesting. I'm really interested to see what the cold open is for next episode.
Yeah,
for
I don't think...
Because the thing is, obviously, like, what we've seen with Blood Money and for Buried so far is that we've got, once the action starts, and not counting the cold open, it's directly leaving. So we've got Hank leaving the bathroom after reading Leaves of Grass.
Yeah.
And, of course, this episode... We had the yellow car and the garage door opening after Walt reveals Heisenberg to Hank.
Well, the thing is, they could be cruel, but I don't know. They could open the next episode with the interrogation door opening and the conversations happened and we just pick up the pieces throughout the episode. I don't know.
Which would be a nice, like, you so you've got the bathroom door opening, you've got the screen door opening.
All these encounters that are happening behind closed doors that I are kind of just
they couldn't.
I don't think they would. No,
there is absolutely
it would be gone. That's what shocked me about this cliffhanger because I thought they were gonna do that scene and then start the next episode in the same place roughly, but they didn't, and you know I can see why. It's a strong cliffhanger, but
it is a strong cliffhanger, but it's an odd one for that moment. I agree with you. I was just like oh come on, dude.
Yeah. Oh, we've only got
five six days That feels wild. Feels like a while. Maybe we should just do season four. Let's
crack open the alcohol and just drink ourselves to death between episodes.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so should we do our favourite...
Yeah, favourite moments. Favourite cold open.
Favourite cold open.
Probably the cold open.
Probably, yeah. Mate, that's a bit of a big call, I think.
Your favourite moment from
I think my funniest moment.
Oh yeah, funniest moment.
Funniest moment is obviously Cubian Hugh.
Obviously, that's one for the ages. That's like, I was really fucking chuckling there.
I really even if I just watch a Better Call Saul movie, like I know, they're really good. Like even if they don't feel like they can stretch it out,
if they
are
subtly promoting Better Call Saul, they're doing a damn good job. Because every time I watch it, really good, damn, I want to watch that show. Mexico.
The conflict on his face is just like,
I know the fact that,
and I also love that they are stand-up comedians, so they are, you know, they have a really, really kind of you know, good sense of timing, which they've learned on the job and responding to audiences, and they know their craft, and it's so lovely to see. I just, yeah, particularly on a show like Breaking Bad, like, I love stuff like that.
Yeah, it knows when to dole out that's comedy. Yeah. So that was a great scene. Yeah, the funniest. What was your favourite scene? Favourite moment? Because I guess if we're picking favourite scenes, you've got two big, chunky 6-minute ones.
Yeah, so but I don't want to go with one of them. You first.
Well, my favourite moment was basically when Marie slapped Skylar.
Okay.
Or either that or the baby. I mean, that whole scene for me was the centerpiece of the other. When I say favourite, I didn't enjoy it, but it was just a very strong, dramatic moment. We've kind of, like, the show had to get to at some point, and if it didn't pull it off, it would have been really bad, but it did pull it off, so I really enjoyed that.
I think the entire Lydia sequence with particularly the fan and the, I don't want to say, it was kind of and you know, the reintroduction of Todd, who I feel like is going to be a really, really, I mean, he's just going to be a really, really important character.
Well, he's essentially set himself out as kind of Lydia's surrogate.
Yeah. And see, this is the thing that, yeah, absolutely. Good word actually. And this
though, do you want my prediction?
What?
I've got a good prediction. I think I know how we get to the flash forward. So Walt has the machine gun. You know how I said he's going to go to rescue Jesse? That was my theory. Just kind of based on instinct. I think I know how that's going to happen. Is Todd's going to die, or Todd's going to quit, or something's going to happen to Todd, or Todd won't be able to cook particularly well. And Lydia, who we now have established really cares about the quality of a product, will get Jesse, and I don't know, she'll kidnap Brock or something. She'll do something that will force him to cook and essentially keep him hostage, and that's who Walt will be going to save at the end. He'll be going up against Lydia and the Nazis.
I just had a thought.
What?
This would be a bit much, though, because it'd almost be too obviously set up.
What?
Jesse's little brother? Maybe? Or is that just a bit too much? I think that's way too much. I feel like we're done with Jesse's parents, definitely.
Yeah,
if you get his brother involved,
think,
you've got to get his
but
parents
also,
involved.
But also, like, there's more...
That's a bit of a season one or two move. It's
yeah,
not,
but there's
it's
more
not really,
drama
yeah.
in Brock.
Yeah.
And Andrea.
Yeah, I suppose.
And I could easily see that coming back, and then somehow you work in.
Also, I just realized his younger brother's probably 17.
But
or
that's the
now.
Other thing.
Yeah.
The actor would have aged so much, it would be kind of
a bit stupid.
In fact, they couldn't do it because only like a year or something has passed, and then they've got this fucking adult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, as I was saying about Lydia, my favorite scene, I think that's just a real kind of like. Really strong kind of, it's a point we have kind of had in the show pretty much the whole time, but we haven't seen it visually really kind of, presented this clearly, and like this, it's not been this literate for a while. I'm really kind of starting to see some kind of, you know, potency in the image just alone, like without, you know, as much as I love a good dialogue scene and objectives kind of warring within a character and without, you know, I really, really like this scene because I dig a bit of science. I also dig a little bit of diversion from the main storyline.
Yeah, but it just kind of came in functionally.
It's brilliant for plot. It's absolutely integral. And
it just has this ominous sense, kind of like the cousins in season 3, like, well, you're wrapped up in your little drama. forces are brewing over here.
Yeah. Mm. And this is the thing, like, by sacrificing Jesse's presence for an episode, you get the Walt... you get the Walt, Hank, Lydia, Emperor aspect, which is a really, really, really interesting one that's kind of starting to come up, which again plays on the Ozymandias. And then you've got the line in the sand with Marie and Skylar. So the thing is, I kind of have read a little bit where people are kind of complaining, oh, nothing really happened. It was all just drama. It was a bit too, like,
It's just drama.
More face-off. But it feels too much like a season one or a season two episode for, like, the final eight episodes of Breaking Bad. No. Like, no. Finally, we've got a really, really strong thematic presence again. Like, really... as big a thing as story and plot and character, which excites me.
Yeah, so I'm really stoked to see that. I think overall this was actually a stronger episode than Blood Money.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I agree. But I just think the scene alone is one of the best. Well, just had lots of great scenes. Probably one of the best this season.
It was more...
As much as I love quotable badassery, like, I'd rather a shot through a fan of Lydia, which to me feels like a metaphor for, you know...
or a callback to incremental crawl space.
Kind of just decay of a soul.
Yeah. Anyway, we better wrap this up. Better head off. That's been the sixth best... I got to count now, make sure we are the sixth. Maybe we're the seventh, maybe we're the fifth. No,
maybe,
I'm pretty sure
maybe we should just... not worry about that and just not be bothered by external coordinates and just follow the true
tone of our internal souls. Actually, but I should just say in general, thanks for listening because our numbers have been good.
Yeah, we've not had numbers like this. It's very odd.
We won't tell you what they are, but they're good.
They're good for us.
So speaking of numbers, if you're listening, you should email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com.
It's not so much numbers as letters, buddy, but...
What?
Speaking of numbers...
No, I just meant speaking of people who are listening to the show, seeing as there are many of you, I think that the law of averages dictates that some of you want to write in, right?
Please, we want to hear.
Yeah, we love some interaction.
Nobody listens to us before now, so this is like, you know, it's like the kid who had no friends in school and then all of a sudden...
You're all invited to our birthday party.
Yeah.
So cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. You can check out our blog, cavaliersdotelevision.blogspot.com. And that's it. And also, you know, we'd love it if you... Oh, God, rate and review us on iTunes. I can't say that.
You can't say that without sounding or feeling like a dickhead.
I know. Yep. I know. But see, by acknowledging that, doesn't that make you want to rate us more? No. Do it. We'd love it if you did it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We'll see you next week with Confession. Oh, what?
That's good. Yeah, we'll see you next week.
Weekend.
I'm Crippy.
Oh, I'm Sorrow. Have a good one. Sol de los arenales. Regada en sangre de babosa y grito. Está volviendo en tu desbocada.